This month's podcast is the second part of highlights from this past year, featuring three of Boston's prominent community leaders who have worked for decades separately and together on issues of civil rights, economic justice, housing, and education. Civil rights leader Hubie Jones, Higher Ground Executive Mozek Hakobian, and JFY Board of Directors Chair Otis Gates. This podcast was created by JFY Networks, a Boston-based nonprofit provider of online learning resources, training, and support. JFY's individualized self-paced curriculum helps raise individual and school performance by maintaining grade-level skills and targeting unfinished learning. For JFY Networks, I'm Greg Cunningham. Three of our podcasts this year had a focus on history and the impact of historic events on the issue of equity in education. Hubie Jones has not only witnessed Boston history for 67 years, but he has also shaped and defined the civic and social landscape. He has been a leader in the formation, building, and rebuilding of at least 30 community organizations in neighborhoods across the city. In our May podcast, during a conversation with JFY Executive Director Gary Kaplan, Hubie discussed his involvement with Boston activist Mel King and the civil rights movement during the early 1960s.
Now Mel was in the picture also with me because in April of 1963, I came up with the idea of having a one-day general strike called STOP, where we would ask all Black people and our white allies to stay out of work for a day to protest all forms of racial discrimination in Boston and not to ride the public transportation and not to shop. And I went to Mel King with the idea, and he thought it was a great idea, and he embraced it. And we brought in some other people to talk about it, including Tom Atkins, who was involved with the NAACP as their administrative secretary or whatever you want to call him. And he sort of bought it, and it took off. The idea took off that we would have a stop day on June 26th to protest all forms of racial discrimination in Boston. And the traditional Black leadership said, no, we're not going to support this. First of all, who are you, Hubie Jones, coming out of nowhere, believing you're going to lead a work stoppage?
What were you doing at the time, Hubie? What was your position?
I was working for the Boston Children's Service Association as a social group worker. I did have a group of young people I worked with who had all kinds of emotional problems in Roxbury. So that was my only connection with Roxbury. I was living in Newton, so there you go. And who are you? Okay. Well, I had Mel King with me.
And Mel, what was he doing at the time, Mel?
Mel, he was working for the United South End Settlements as a social worker. He ran for school committee that summer, okay, in 1963. He stood up with me. At one point, Ken Guskett got so angry with me about this whole thing. He said he'd whip my ass if I persisted. I said, Oh, really? Oh, okay. But it was basically, you don't get into leadership unless you go through the essential rituals of starting at the bottom and working your way up. You don't come in and try to be a leader. They couldn't stop. They couldn't stop because it took off. People said they were going to stay out of work. And in fact, Attorney General Edward Brooke called a meeting on June 13th, 1963, where he called all Black leaders together to talk about all of the things that were popping loose, okay, in the Black community.
What was that date again?
It was the 13th.
June 13th. Sorry, go ahead.
So he calls this meeting, and basically white leadership and business leadership go to him to say, look, take care of the natives in the in the Black community, okay? Get in there and see what the hell's going on. You know, we can't deal with all this stuff. Okay. I mean, I got calls directly from business people, you know, saying, hey, these folks are saying they're not coming to work at the Credential Tower. You know, they're not going to show up. Hey, I can't clean the office buildings down there. I said, well, that's the point. The point is we want you to understand what's going on here. But that's the point. Okay. So anyway, so Ed Brook comes in to meet with all the black leaders. Okay. And I get a call saying, hey, Hubie, where are you? You better get down here to represent STOP, because he's going over all of these actions that are going forward, and the STOP's going to be coming up. So you better get here. I said, well, is Mel King in the room? Yeah, he's in the room. Well, tell Mel to hold the fort. I'll be there. So when I got there.
Why weren't you there in the first place?
I didn't know about the meeting.
Oh, they didn't let you know.
I didn't know about the meeting.
They didn't want you there.
I don't know. All I know, I wasn't. I got there one hot June night, hot, the place steaming. There's Ed Brook sitting in the front, you know, movie star, smooth, handsome, but he was ruffled that night because everybody was at him. I remember Alma Lewis sort of clawing at him. Ed, you don't understand what we're going through. These folks are giving us no choice but to have demonstrate and to come at them in very tough ways. We have no other course to do. You don't understand what's going on. So they asked me to stand up.
Where was the meeting?
It was at the St. Mark's Social Center. Okay. It was a social center for the St. Mark's Church, Congregational Church in Rossburg. So he says, what's this STOP thing? It says Ed Brook. So I jump up and I say, okay, this is what STOP is. We're asking people to stay home. And this is the reasons. It protests all forms of immigration, blah, 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 blah. He says, well, if you shoot your ammunition and it's all over, what do you got? So he's making the case for the fact for not doing anything. I said, look, all I can tell you, this is beyond Mel King and me. The people out there in the streets are going to stay or out of work. Okay, there's nothing we can do about it, even if we wanted to, and we're not going to do anything about it. Okay, it's time to make it clear that we're not going to take this stuff anymore. Okay, so all of a sudden, up jumps Tom Atkins and says, "Look, something has to happen on June 26th because people are expecting something to happen. So why don't we turn this into a memorial service for Medgar Evers, who was murdered the day before in Mississippi? Let's have a memorial service on the Boston Common for Medgar Evers." And we say, fine, you have a memorial service? Great. We'll march the people who stay out of work to the Boston Common. Okay, so fine. Okay, so on the morning of the memorial service, which is on the 26th, stop day, we have like 500 people who show up at a rally at the park in Lower Roxbury. We then put everybody in line with Mel King and I leading a march down Columbus Avenue. We got police escorts and all that stuff down Columbus Avenue to the Boston Common. As we were marching down Columbus Avenue, we're waving to people who are hanging out of the windows, come on down, join us, come on down. And people started running out of their houses. So by the time we got to the Common, we had 1,000 people. So we marched around the Common, we didn't go right into the Common. We went all the way around Beacon Street, around past the State House, and people were stunned, looking at us with stony silence as we marched this group of 1,000 people around. And we finally get to the Parkman Bandstand. And as the people who were there already saw us, they all stood up on their seats and started clapping. Tom Atkins, who was pissed, looks at me and says, take your folks and put them over there. Well, he thought STOP was dead. And so he was surprised that this whole thing came to life. Now, a agreement was made that I was supposed to speak at the memorial service, but I was never called on. So that happened. But the interesting thing was, is that September, after the March on Washington, which was a kind of a pause because everybody was going to the March on Washington. Unfortunately, I didn't go because I was involved in something else with the Center Club, with a camp I was running for ex-mental patients. So Atkins in September throws an olive branch to the school committee saying, here's a plan for how you can desegregate the schools voluntarily by changing district lines, and there would not be any very much transportation of kids. Okay.
This is 1963.
1963 in September.
And the NAACP is proposing a desegregation plan.
Voluntary.
Voluntary. Holy cow.
Okay. And it would involve much transportation of kids. Louise Day Hicks rejects it, saying that constitutes gerrymandering and that's unconstitutional. We'll have nothing to do with it. Well, it was a lot of nonsense. What she knew was that she had political currency by standing in opposition to Black demands. And that September, she got more votes than John Collins, the popular sitting mayor, which proved that it was working.
In her reelection campaign for the school committee.
The whole committee, yeah. It's working for all of the folks. Now let's jump forward because
throw in a question. What was Collins doing all this time about all this stuff?
Collins was basically not doing anything.
Hiding out?
Basically he saw his role as redevelopment of the city. And he had done for Black folks what all he could do by his relationship with the Snowdens at Freedom House in giving them the urban renewal that they wanted in Washington Park in Roxbury. He had their support, and he was not going to be diverted from his rebuilding the city by getting involved in all of the wild stuff that was going on.
In our October podcast, Moses Kokobian, the executive director of Higher Ground, a JFY Network's partner, first discussed how he met and came to know Hubie Jones before the founding of Higher Ground in 2010.
So Hubie Jones, who founded Higher Ground, and I had served on the board of the Boston Housing Partnership for a number of years. And in fact, before that, I used to watch Hubie on television. There was a program called 5 on 5. And he was my favorite commentator, sort of on the left, on the progressive side. And I believe, I think his name was Bobby Davis, if I'm remembering this correctly, who was sort of the conservative voice, and the two of them would go at it. So I used to watch that. And then when I met him on the Boston Housing Partnership board, I was really impressed that somebody that I used to watch on television and hang on every word of his. We were now serving on a board together. So we got to be good friends and colleagues.
Moses continued to discuss with Gary Kaplan how Higher Ground is a catalyst for collective action, working with residents and partners to achieve higher outcomes in education and to promote the health and well-being of children and families in Roxbury, Dorchester, and Mattapan.
You know, it's not just finding a place for families to live. It's also what else do they need to continue to have stable housing? The BHA has been a great partner in providing both housing units and vouchers. The New Lease for Homeless Families has been a great resource where they're it's an organization made up of affordable housing developers across the state. So they commit every third or fourth vacancy for families that we and other service providers refer to them. So once the families are housed, then the question is, how do you support them? What other needs, what other service needs do they have? So part of the stabilization process for a year or more after they're housed is just making sure they have all the services they need, all the access that they need. So the Boston Children's Hospital was one of the major funders of our homelessness initiative. About, I guess, 2019, they launched an initiative focused on children's health equity. Concerned that not all children and families in Boston have equal access to health services, both physical and mental health. And it seemed like a natural thing for us to explore building on our experience with the schools, to use the schools as a lever or a connection to the families and see what we could do in collaboration with the schools to improve health and mental health of the children and families that the schools serve. The schools that were already in our homelessness initiative and Chris Posadas collectively serve over 1,000 kids or 1,200 kids and their families. So given the history that we had and the relationship that we had, it seemed like it was a natural thing to explore an initiative where we and some of the partners we've worked with over the years would provide enrichment services, not just to homeless families, but also to all the families and students in those schools. So we approached, I should back up again and just say, as I mentioned earlier, the initial vision and continuing vision of Higher Ground is not to duplicate services that exist, but basically connect services to each other and the families they're trying to serve. So we've worked with Families First, Smart from the Start, America's Promise Alliance, a domestic violence program that was out of the Brigham and Women's Hospital, Nurturee, the Teen Empowerment, obviously, with whom we share offices. So when this opportunity came along, we approached the partners we've worked with before, and a number of them said, yes, we're interested in joining forces in this coalition. You know, we started putting together a planning, you know, so Children's Hospital had a planning grant that they gave to coalitions who applied. Six coalitions were selected for a planning grant. Ours was one of them. In the process of applying for the planning grant, a number of other organizations that were interested asked to join our coalition, and that's how the Surround Care Coalition came about. As you know, we developed a plan together over 2019-2020. The planning period was extended by 3 months because of the pandemic, and we submitted an implementation proposal for the plan we had developed together with the nonprofits and the schools and BPS. And fortunately, ours was one of the four coalitions selected for a three-year $1 million implementation grant. And we're now in the first year of that implementation process. And JFY Network is obviously one of the partners in that effort. One of the key things about the Surround Care Coalition is that I think an important concept is that all of these nonprofit partners are agreeing to aggregate the services they're already going to provide and focus them in the set of schools that are partners with us in this coalition. So by doing that, the 14 nonprofit partners were able to essentially commit over the next 3 years, $2 million of essentially their own resources, because these are things they were going to do and pay for. It's just that they're going to focus on these set of schools in Roxbury and Dorchester. And that commitment of $2 million of resource became a key part of our proposal, that we were essentially planning a three-year $4.5 million implementation plan, which allowed us to do a much more robust program with the $1 million from Children's Hospital. We are collectively raising the other $1.5 million that we will need over the next 3 years. And we've made good progress in meeting our targets for the first year from a variety of sources. And we're encouraged that we will be able to do that for the 3 years. Our goal is to make the three schools and Crispus Attucks Children's Center an excellent local educational network that has, you know, where we reduce homelessness to zero, hopefully, where families have access to health and mental health services. And it becomes, just like we helped the Crispus Attucks Children's Center increase their enrollment by working together, investing in the facilities, making clear that this center has a future, people could come there and know that it'll be meeting their needs. We think that the same thing can happen on a larger scale with this network of schools. They will become schools of choice instead of the default schools for people to go to, because the enrichment programs, the physical improvements, the support that they're getting from all the partners improve educational outcomes to the level where everybody in the neighborhood will want to have their kids enrolled in that school, in these schools. We think we're on track to do that over the next 3 years. We believe that in both the Homelessness Initiative and the Surround Care Coalition, aside from the services we're trying to provide, what we're trying to do consistent with Higher Ground's original mission and Hubie's vision is essentially to change the system so that it is really delivering for the families by various parts of the system working together. Because quite often, this, you know, 10 or 15 organizations are trying to provide services to the same family, but it's 15 doors that that family has to go through to get every service. But if those services can be coordinated and that family can have access to all those services from one location, in this case, the schools, it's efficient for the delivery system and it's more beneficial to the families. And I think between those two initiatives, what we hope to demonstrate is that there can be a more collaborative and collective effort that will deliver more benefits to the people for whom it's intended, and the system itself can be much more efficient and much more effective.
So this kind of work, most coalition building and all these associations, this all must take an awful lot of meetings and talking and negotiation. Do you find it easy to get this kind of cooperation happening when you suggest something to an organization or to an institution? Do they just say, hey, that's a great idea. Sure, we'll do it. And you've been doing this for quite a few years. In fact, quite a few decades. Do you find it an easy or a difficult way of doing business?
So fortunately, I've had good training at the Urban Edge. I mean, you don't do affordable housing development alone. Every CDC practitioner will tell you that to do a major affordable housing project, you may have 10 or 15 partners, both in terms of community level partners, political support partners.
In December, as part of our conversation with JFY Network's board of directors, we heard from Board Chair Otis Gates, the founder of UHM Properties, formerly United Housing Management, the largest minority-owned developer, owner, and manager of affordable housing in Roxbury and North Dorchester. As he described his journey with JFY and how the organization has adjusted while focusing on educational equity during its long history.
Well, you know, early on, before we got to the point that we are now doing distance learning, the students that we served came to Jobs for Youth. They came to JFY, and we had a graduation ceremony. And the graduation ceremony for the programs that we had was absolutely amazing. The students who were graduating would bring members of their family. You'd think they won the Super Bowl when they got their diploma, because these students were the ones who were left behind. This was an accomplishment to get that diploma or to finish the program that JFY was providing. We got high school students, some students got high school diplomas, others got jobs because we had a job training program that we used to work on that got hazmat jobs. And in fact, I'll just give you one example of the kind of thing that happened. There was a young woman who came to us as a single mother. She went through the GED program and got her high school diploma, and then she finished the hazmat program. And eventually she had gotten a job over at MIT working on the human genome. And she came back to us as one of the speakers at our graduation. She was explaining what the human genome was about, because she'd risen to the level of a supervisor. And she said she was so shy and lacked such confidence. If there were more than two people in the room, she wouldn't open her mouth. Just seeing that kind of thing is what makes it worthwhile. And so, I mean, sometimes it feels like we're kind of out with a spoon trying to shovel sand in the ocean there. But I can tell you that one grain of sand, one individual, makes it worthwhile being in an organization that can help someone that way. We have other examples of that. There are several others that I could cite, but that's the thing. That's the reward that you get for doing the kind of work that we do. Because the problem is that we have a great many talented people. Talent is everywhere. It's distributed randomly. And it's not distributed on the basis of exam schools and the rest of that. So the problem is, how do you get that talent forward so that we can all benefit from what these people have to offer us? That's what keeps me connected.
What do you think, when you look into the future, what do you think the future of JFY looks like?
Well, I think it looks great. I mean, you know, just the fact that we've survived for over 40 years as this organization is an unbelievable thing to be. I've seen a lot of organizations, nonprofit organizations like ours, that have just disappeared. So given that we've survived, I would hope that those who come on after us can continue this because the opportunity is great and the need is great. We have the tools that can help us move forward. So, and I think this experience with COVID has brought people forward in, we've had a lot of challenges there, personal and organizationally and so on, but it's provided an opportunity to learn, to get familiar with the new technology and to see what advantages there are in it for you. There are certainly problems with it, but there's some things that were good that can be helpful and that can be used. And people are no longer teachers and others, other adults are no longer afraid of this technology. It's here to stay. And they've learned how to use it. So I think that is one less hurdle that we'll have to try to overcome as we try to deliver our service. So I think the future is bright. And it's just you've just reported in our meeting, you know, the word is out there to the schools. They understand. And so we're getting some responses from places we've never heard from before. So I think the future for us is positive.
We would like to thank all of our guests for joining us this year on a JFY Networks podcast. If you missed any of our monthly podcasts, you can find them wherever podcasts can be found, including on our website. We hope you'll join us next month for part two of our conversation with Hubie Jones as he continues his story of shaping the civil rights movement in Boston.
Well, John O'Brien played a major role in forming this citizen committee where people who were wanting to run for office had to come before the committee to get their support. And if you didn't get their support, the likelihood was that you wouldn't do well. Even white candidates running for statewide office, etc., came before this committee to get the support of the black community.
Our Hubie Jones Part 2 podcast will publish on September 29th. If you have any questions or comments, please navigate to our website, jfynet.org, which also features a wealth of commentary, dialogue, and free scholastic resources to support all educational communities. Thank you for joining us. For JFY Networks, I'm Greg Cunningham.